inflation, good and bad. Tonight we'll be talking about various kinds of deflation and whether they're good or bad from the point of view of the economy and society as a whole. And the rationale for doing this is the fact that most politicians and many economists, the great majority of the economic profession, are what I would call deflation phobes. That is, they have a fear of falling prices. So let me just center myself better here for you to see me. Let me just talk. I sort of used this term back in 2002 in an article that I wrote. But the term deflation, others have used it since, by the way. But the term deflation phobia, as you see here, is as I define it, morbid fear of falling prices. Okay, falling prices that are caused by natural market forces, as we'll see. The word deflation, which I'll talk a little about its meaning and the history of the word, by the way, is a very inaccurate way of describing prices that are declining as a result of economic growth or some other reason that people would like to hold more money on the market. And as I pointed out, or as I will show, central banks tend to use deflation to scare people into justifying or into accepting their policies, which are basically inflationary. And so the so-called inflation targeting that most banks are explicitly, many central banks are explicitly engaging in currently, including the Bank of England and European Central Bank, most banks justify this as a way of avoiding deflation. And in fact, Bernanke is a big supporter of inflation targeting, although there's nothing legal that mandates the Fed to target inflation to keep it within certain bounds. But one of the explicit aims of the Fed is to maintain inflation up to 2%, that is not to exceed 2% in a given year. Okay, inflation as defined by the CPI or the personal consumption expenditure index or some other government created and the very artificial index. So let's go to the next slide here. Alan Greenspan really started this latest round of deflation phobia. Okay, there was deflation phobia in the 1930s, or actually right after the 1930s. Once we recovered from the Depression and World War II was ended, there was a situation in which the Fed and many mainstream economists who were under Keynesian influence beginning in the 1950s would always point to the Great Depression as a reason for avoiding any sort of approach toward deflation. Because in their minds and in their writings, deflation was more or less synonymous with depression. That is, it was deflation that caused the Great Depression, according to them, or at least exacerbated it greatly. Okay. In Milton Friedman's mind, it actually turned, as we talked about last week, a garden variety recession into the Great Depression. But in any case, Alan Greenspan in April 2003 made a number of statements. Now, Greenspan was known for his circumlocution, that is, talking around the point, saying things in a very obscure way, but making them sound very ominous. For example, in April 2003, you can see there, he proclaimed that a further drop in inflation was, quote, an unwelcome development. Okay. Now, he wasn't complaining about deflation occurring. He was saying that inflation dropping was dangerous, okay, and unwelcome. Later, the Federal Open Market Committee, which is the monetary policy-making committee of the Federal Reserve, this was just a few weeks later, indicated that there was a minor probability that, and they, again, using Greenspan's terminology, since he was chair of the Fed and of the Federal Open Market Committee, he called it an unwelcome substantial fall in inflation, okay, and that outweighed the risk of higher inflation. So what's so bad about that? The fact that inflation is falling, not that we're having deflation or that prices are falling, but that the rate of deflation of inflation is falling. The rate at which prices are rising is slowing down. Okay, that's all a drop in inflation means. But yet they were trying to imply that there was something destructive about this, or potentially destructive about this. And then finally, when he testified before Congress at the end of April, Greenspan wrote, "We see no," or said, "We see no credible possibility that we will at any point run out of monetary ammunition to address problems of deflation." So a problem that he had created himself through his own words, he was now telling us that he also had the solution to, that the Fed would never run out of ammunition, meaning that there were always tools that the Fed possessed that would enable it to increase the money supply and prevent deflation. So the whole problem of deflation was created by certain statements that Greenspan made. And mind you, that the U.S. economy had not experienced any deflation since before World War II at that point. So moving to the next slide. It was actually a little bit before that, in a speech, a now famous speech by the then Fed governor. He wasn't chair yet. He wasn't chairman yet. Ben Bernanke. He gave a speech in Washington to a group of prominent businessmen, and he entitled it "Deflation: Making Sure It Doesn't Happen Here." Again, it hadn't happened here since the 1930s, but yet he's trying to assure the American public who had not heard of this problem at all. I mean, hadn't heard that there was any sort of danger of deflation in the modern day U.S. Trying to assure them that, don't worry, it will not happen here. So in the speech he said, "So having said deflation in the U.S. is highly unlikely," okay, I mean, it's highly unlikely, "I would be imprudent to rule out the possibility altogether." So he's opening the door, he's creaking a little bit to the possibility that inflation was just, or deflation was just over the horizon, okay? So all this was very disingenuous. It was misleading the American people into thinking that we faced a problem or an event that would be called, that could be called deflation. So he was trying to raise in the public minds the idea that, you know, we could fall into a Great Depression unless the great Fed stepped in with basically inflationary policies. And then in the rest of the speech, he talked about how the Fed had the tools, and many of them would be new tools. These tools actually were used later on after the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, and so on. All of these unconventional tools like quantitative easing, forward guidance of interest rates, that is the Fed telling you what interest rates are forecast to be according to themselves in the future. And of course, they would tell you that, well, you know, we forecast the interest rates remain low. So if you forecast interest rates to remain low, your purpose in doing so, whether or not you really believe they're going to remain low, is to have people borrow and spend more money, both businesses and households. Don't worry, you know, you can borrow to buy a house using an adjustable rate mortgage. We're not going to allow interest rates to go up. So if they're forecast, if they're the people that are supposedly controlling interest rates, and at the same time they're forecasting that they'll be low, what they're saying is we're going to keep interest rates low, okay, by injecting tremendous amounts of money into the economy. And finally, we come to the point where not just deflation is worrisome, or the prospect of deflation is worrisome, but now a new term has been coined, lowflation. We don't want inflation to get too low. We don't want prices to rise too slowly, okay? Because if they do, that gets near the area of deflation. So, for example, the IMF managing director, her name is Christine Lagarde, in a statement a few weeks ago, said, quote, "There is the emerging risk of what I call lowflation, particularly in the euro area, a potentially prolonged period of low inflation can suppress demand and output and suppress growth and jobs. So now they're telling us that having no inflation is not potentially a good thing, that getting rid of inflation is not good because it's going to cause indications or symptoms, I guess is the word, symptoms of recession, okay? Fewer jobs, less economic growth, or actually no growth. She then went on to say that the solution is more monetary easing. So whenever you hear monetary easing, what that means is monetary inflation, okay? And of course, she confirmed that, you know, they have unconventional measures, meaning just different ways of increasing the money supply, okay? So now let me go back to deflation and the kinds of deflation there are, and see if the Fed and many economists and Christine Lagarde and other people now that who are worried about low inflation, whether they are justified in doing so. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the meaning of deflation. Okay, in the 19th century, what deflation meant was a decrease in the stock of money. Okay, not falling prices, but simply the money supply decreasing, maybe because the number of banks were failing and people's deposits were just disappearing, or because for some reason the U.S. government or some other government was deliberately deflating the money supply. This happened in the 1870s when the U.S. was going back onto the gold standard after having gone off of the gold standard during the Civil War. By producing a lot of paper money and suspending gold redemption by the banks in order to finance the Civil War. Both the North and the South did this, resulted in a great inflation of prices. And so when the Civil War ended, the decision was made by Congress to go back to the gold standard, but they did it very slowly. From 1870 to 1879, they deflated deliberately the stock of money. Basically called in the greenbacks and burned them, okay? So the stock of money was falling during that period. That was deflation, okay? A fall in the supply of money. Then in the early 20th century, deflation began to mean, and this also is true for deflation or inflation, it would mean a change in the stock of money relative to the needs of trade, okay? Meaning how much money you needed to maintain prices at the same level, okay? So the next step was really just to change the meaning of deflation from simply a decrease in the money supply to a decrease in prices, okay? That definition of a decrease in the money supply relative to the needs of trade, that is, you can keep the money supply constant, and if there's economic growth, prices will begin to fall because with more goods on the market, you're going to have the same quantity of money. And if people have the same demand for money, that means that suddenly the prices of goods, in order to have those additional goods sold, will have to fall. Okay. So it was just simpler to define, and this was done in the early 20th century, deflation as a falling prices. Okay, and so that's the modern definition, a decrease in the price level or in overall prices. And Ludwig von Mises, the great Austrian economist, in his book Human Action in 1949, originally published in English in 1949, argued that in flat fact words inflation and deflation were just very ambiguous terms, and a better way to talk about what was happening was to say that when prices rose, the value of money, each dollar bought less, so the value of money was depreciating. And when prices were falling, since that meant that each dollar would buy more or each monetary unit would purchase more goods and services, we would then say that the value of money is appreciating. Now, that sounds like something good, right? That the value of money is going up, okay? It's a neutral term. It's just saying that the money buys more, so therefore, as prices fall, money is appreciating. Or money buys less as prices rise, so money is depreciated. But that makes it sound a little bit too attractive to have falling prices. So the term deflation, which has very negative connotations, is used instead today. Okay. As I said, a more descriptive term, more accurate term would simply be to say that when prices fall, the value of money is appreciating. Okay, it's going up. Okay. Now, just to mention very quickly, deflation and inflation always refer to consumer goods prices. Okay, that's what we're interested in, for two reasons. First of all, consumer goods are the final output of the economy. It's what everybody's focused on. Everyone earns an income in order to purchase these final goods and services to satisfy their wants. Okay, so it's the price of consumer goods that are the key. And secondly, as consumer prices rise, all other prices will rise. That is, all prices of capital goods, which we call produced means of production. Those are goods like factories and equipment, software programs, business software programs. All those things are produced only with the purpose of aiding in the production of final consumer goods. So as prices of consumer goods go up, their prices and values are imputed backwards to the goods that produce them, including the original inputs into the process, labor and land. Okay, so we need not focus on the prices of capital goods or labor and land, okay, because they follow, okay, in the broad scheme of things, they follow the prices of consumer goods. So when you look at the measures, so-called measures of inflation, official measures of inflation, they always focus on consumer goods, consumer price indexes, the CPI, the personal consumption expenditure index, which is another way of computing changes in price of computer goods, and there are others. So what are the kinds of inflation, of deflation, okay? Before we can really talk about the kinds of deflation, what I want to point out is that money's like any other commodity, okay, any other good in the economy, in that its value is determined by supply and demand. In the case of money, it doesn't have a single price, but it has what we call a purchasing power, or PPM. So the purchasing power of money is really the alternative quantity of all the other goods and services that money can purchase in the economy. So money doesn't have a single price, but it has a price on every market in the economy. Okay, it's simply the inverse of the prices of all other goods. So if a pizza is, I think we talked about this last week, if a pizza costs you $10, then the price of a dollar is one-tenth of a pizza. If a bottle of water costs you a dollar, then the price of a dollar is simply one bottle of water. The price of water doubles to, let's say, $2, well, then the price of a dollar is only a half a bottle of water because it can only buy half as much. So, when we have an increase in the purchasing power of money or a fall, it means that there's a fall in overall prices, okay? And that can be the cause, and we're talking about inflation. So when prices fall and the purchasing power of money rises, the value of money goes up, that can be caused either by an increase in demand for money or a decrease in the supply of money, okay? With less money, money becomes more valuable. On the other hand, if you keep the quantity of money the same, and there's an increase in demand for money, then it becomes more valuable. Okay. And we also want to mention that deflation can be called good or bad from the point of view of its effect on consumers, its effect on the economic welfare of those for whom the economy is run, and that is the consumers. Okay. So we'll talk about that. And now what I want to do is to show you two diagrams that illustrate the movements in the supply and or demand for money, and shows what happens. These diagrams will show what happens to the purchasing power of money when the demand, its demand or supply changes. So let me just this throws everything at you at once. I wanted to show you the movement here, so let me just get Danny in here to show you how this will play out. Okay. So what you see on the screen here is the supply of money, MS1, okay, suddenly shifting back for whatever reason. Either the government is during after the Civil War is decreasing the amount of paper money in the economy, or banks are failing. Whatever reason, if you have a decrease in the supply of money. So if you have a decrease in supply of money, what's going to happen, as you'll see, is in a moment, is that the price adjusts to equate the quantity of money demanded with the money supply. So you move up from point A. If you look at point A, notice that the value of money is very low. Okay, so the price of, let's say, this is a bottle of water is $4. Okay, if you look on the right axis. Look on the right axis, excuse me, you'll see that that's the price level. Okay, so it's $4. And that means that for every dollar, you can buy one-fourth of a bottle of water. But as you have a decrease in the supply of money, money becomes more valuable. Okay, prices fall. Okay, so on the right axis, they go down to $2. And then if you go across on the left axis, what that means is that the value of money is the reciprocal of the price. So it's one half of a bottle of water. So now the value of money has risen, okay? Because there are fewer dollars in the economy, each dollar can purchase more. Each dollar can now purchase one half of a bottle of water instead of a quarter of a bottle of water. So there's no interruption of the exchange process in the market, okay? That is, even with fewer dollars, because the purchasing power of money has adjusted, right, you're able to purchase the full amount of goods and services in the economy. And all I'm doing there is really using water, bottled water, as a proxy for all the other goods and services. So now let's look at what happens with increasing demand. Okay. So now we have an increase in the demand for money. Okay, it goes from MD1, okay, to MD2, and in that case, you'll see the two intersection points where MD1 intersects with the supply of money. That's known as the equilibrium point. So again, prices of money are about the prices of, let's say, a bottle of water is about $2. And let's see if I can show you that. Yeah, so it's $2. And the value of a dollar is one half of a bottle of water. Okay. But then as the demand increases, and we'll talk about why demand for money would increase, as the demand increases, what you get then is a new equilibrium. Okay, suddenly it looks like, you know, people want to hold $2,000, and there's only $1,000 available in the economy. Let's say the Fed only supplies $1,000 and doesn't increase the supply of money. So what happens is suddenly there's what we might call a shortage of money, but on the market it doesn't last. The market has its own corrective mechanism. Okay, so if people have an increased demand for money, what they're going to do is begin to spend less. Okay. If you want to hold money, let's say you're going to go on a European vacation in a few months, and you're going to have to come up with $4,000. During those months leading up to that, if you have to come up with $4,000, you're going to begin to cut back on what you're spending today, okay? And you're going to build your cash up, okay, either in currency or in your checking account, so you can write that check. To either pay directly for the vacation or pay off the credit card company when you go on the vacation. You're going to have more cash. And in doing so, everyone cuts back on spending if they want to hold more money. And when that occurs, the demand for goods falls and prices of those goods go down. And so the value of money rises. So notice now the price of a bottle of water as a result of a cutback in spending falls from $2 to $1.33. Which means that each dollar can buy more, three quarters of a bottle of water. And so let me just, I think I talk about the, Okay, what we're doing is we're just adjusting back to the regular PowerPoint slides here. So we're going to talk about the cause of deflation, and then we're going to refer back to those diagrams and the analysis of those diagrams. So there are four basic causes of deflation, okay? in an article that I wrote back in 2005 or so, I talked about this. So I categorize them as growth deflation, cash building deflation, bank credit deflation, and finally, fiscatory deflation. And there you can see in parentheses that what I've done is, from the point of view certainly of Austrian economics, characterize them as good or bad. So the first three, since they're generated on the market and are consistent with the desires of consumers on the market, they're good. Okay, and the fourth kind, confiscatory, which comes from the word confiscation, as confiscating your tax money. As we'll see, the government can also confiscate your bank deposits, okay, and has done so on a number of occasions, but I'll talk about that. So let's go to the next slide. So what about growth deflation? Let's start with that, because that's probably the most important type of deflation in a market economy, okay? And it's very simple to explain. It's really caused by an increase in the supply of supplies of goods and services in the economy, which is sometimes, using a biological analogy, called economic growth. But as Mises and Rothbard have argued, the term economic growth is potentially misleading, because a body would grow automatically, okay? So you have to be very careful of using that biological analogy or metaphor in economics. Okay, really, what it means is that there's an increase in the number of supplies of goods and services in the economy. It doesn't have to be all of them. It can be just in the high tech industries, or it can be in some other area of the economy. But economic growth means that supplies are increasing, and that therefore the prices of those goods are falling. Now, there's nothing automatic about this process. As you see in bullet point two, economic growth doesn't just occur, okay? It has to be preceded and caused by an increase in investment in capital goods, okay, and technological process or progress, right? So when you have an increase in investment, what happens is that you embody some of technological innovations into various kinds of capital goods. Okay, and that increases the productivity of labor in the economy. So you have more goods and services. Now, if labor can produce, each labor can produce more because it's working with more and better capital goods, then what happens is that your production costs go down. Okay, you're paying the laborer a certain amount of money, and he or she is now producing more goods and services. And what will then occur is that you'll have your production costs going down. That is, your labor cost per unit of output goes down, and that means your profit margin increases. Okay, so economic growth, as we call it, is brought about by additional savings that allows this additional investment. Okay, but now what's the consequence or implication of that? Well, when you have more goods and services, when the supply of a good goes up, okay, there's more goods that are trying to be sold by sellers for dollars. They have more goods on their hands, more inventory. There's more production in the economy. So they're thrown on the market or offered on the market for dollars. So there's greater competition for dollars. And that's simply an increase in the demand for money. Okay, that is that sellers who now have more goods that have been produced are all scrambling to sell these additional goods. And all that's going to do then, that increase in the demand for dollars, is to drive down prices. Okay, so if the money supply is fixed, and it usually is not in the modern world, the Fed and other central banks are always increasing it, but let's assume it's fixed, this results in each dollar purchasing more goods and services. That is an increase in the purchasing power of money. Okay, and a fall in capital P. Capital P refers to the entire price level. Okay, so it results in what the mainstream economists would call, deflation. Better term, as I said before, is simply an increase in the value of money, or an appreciation in the value of money. So if we move to the next slide, we'll see that growth deflation has occurred in the U.S. and in other market economies, okay, and certainly under the gold standard in the 19th century, this was the normal state of affairs. That is a slow decline in prices as capital investment and technological progress proceeded, and that led to an increase in the amount of goods and services that were being produced, okay? So in order for that to happen, the percentage increase in goods would have to outstrip or be greater than, that's what that symbol means there, than the increase in supply of money. And under the gold standard in the 19th century, supply of money increased very slowly because gold mining was very difficult, gold was scarce, and the supply of money did not keep pace with the increase in supply of goods and services. So prices naturally fell, okay? And this is a good inflation, a good deflation, because it was a consequence and manifested the fact that we were becoming richer. We had more goods and services. Each of our dollars were buying more now. This occurred throughout the 19th century. And just to give you a very stark case here, from 1880 to 1896, when the U.S. was transforming itself into one of the greatest industrial powers in the world, overtaking Great Britain, what happened was that, in fact, this occurred during a period of falling prices. Something that the mainstream economists would claim today, well, couldn't happen. Even lowflation or low inflation would suppress growth and jobs. But that didn't happen in the 19th century. If you look at it, you see that, in fact, percentage decrease in prices over that 17-year period was 30%. So prices were falling by about 1.75% per year, okay? But at the same time, real GDP, or the real goods and services being produced annually, they rose by 85% over that period, or 5% per year, okay? So at the same time prices were declining, we had a very rapid increase in goods and services being produced, and therefore in living standards. And as Milton Friedman has even admitted, the 1880s was the decade in U.S. history that had the greatest rate of growth, okay? So growth deflation certainly did not lead to depression during the 1880s and into the 1890s, and it certainly doesn't have to today, and would not today. So here's a view of growth deflation in the 19th century. There was an inflation, a bank credit inflation in the 1820s. Okay, so let me just show you this with an arrow here. Leading up to the 1820s, excuse me. So if you'll note, we had a very high price level leading up to the 1820s. As I said, the bank credit inflation. Then there was the first depression in the U.S. It was called the Panic of 1819. Prices came back to a normal level, but they continued to fall as the economy continued to grow, okay? We then also had a bank credit inflation occurring in the late 1830s, okay? That was during President Jackson's administration, and Jackson had sworn, like Thomas Jefferson, to get rid of the second bank of the U.S., which was a quasi-central bank. The bank credit inflation led to a inflation in the economy, and then eventually that came to an end, the inflationary boom, and we began to have a deflation, okay? As prices fell, banks collapsed. And then we had a period of very stable prices. Then the Civil War came, we had paper money inflation, greenback inflation, and as you can see here, once we got to around the 1870s, and the government began to, the U.S. government began to liberally deflate the money supply, we had a fall in the money supply. But even in 1880s, after that was all over and we were back on the gold standard, notice that prices continued to fall, okay? Fell by about 25%, or as I said before, by about 30%, down to 1896, around 1900. Then there was more gold discoveries after that, and prices rose very, very slowly by less than 1% per year up until World War I, okay? But notice that even if that were the case, if we were up a little further in 1914, price had been up a little bit, maybe to here, you see where the arrow is, it's still much lower than it even was in 1800. So prices fell because of economic growth during the 19th century. And during a period when the U.S. began to rapidly industrialize. So again, it didn't put a damper on growth, let alone plunge us into a deep depression. So let me just go to the next slide here. So let's look at some recent examples of growth deflation, which is occurring all around us, even as I speak. Mainframe computers cost $4.7 million in 1970. And as I point out there, today PCs, are 20 times faster, have much more memory, and you can get them for less than $500, okay, including accessories. So that's a tremendous growth deflation. Now, did this deflation of computer prices, excuse me, I have a very annoying fly here. I don't think he agrees with my whole shtick on deflation. But anyway, did that cause a depression and unemployment in the computer industry? Well, absolutely not. If you look from 1980, and I didn't update these figures, to 1999, price of computers fell by about 90%. Okay, huge decline in prices. But yet, the industry in 1980 shipped about 400,000 or 500,000 PCs, okay? But yet, by 1999, it was shipping approximately 86 times as many, right? So 43 million were shipped in 1999. And of course, today, if you include tablet computers and all kinds of electronic devices that have computing capabilities, we ship way more. Okay, so the industry actually expanded. We have much more employment than we did in 1980, and yet prices have fallen by 90%, and that's just by 1999. Fallen by much more than that up to the present day. Some other interesting examples of growth deflation. Hand calculators, when they first came out in 1970, Texas Instruments, I believe, was the first producer of them, costs in 1970 prices $240. In today's prices, that's something like $1,400, okay, in today's prices. But yet, by 1980, the price was less than $10. So in 10 years, prices just collapsed. Well, they didn't collapse in the sense that the demand fell. The prices fell because cost of production fell because of the tremendous technological innovation, the microchip revolution during the 1970s, which drove down production costs and caused a lot more competition. Other firms began to produce hand calculators. And so prices, the competition among these companies forced prices down along with the cost. Okay. So you had a massive increase in the industry despite the fall in prices of hand calculators. But today you can get you can get the same kind of hand calculator you can barely add and subtract on the old Texas Instruments hand calculator, and now you have a much better quality hand calculator selling for $5 and less. Okay, HDTV, similar story. The price in 1990 was about $36,000. Okay, that was really just for the prototype. By 2003, they were $3,000 to $5,000, and then today they're much higher quality. Prices, you can get them for as low as $500, and as I said, with a higher quality. Laser eye surgery, something this is interesting also from the point of view of the so-called inevitable and inexorable increase in prices of medical care. Okay, certainly laser eye surgery, which is not something that the that medical insurance reimburses because it's cosmetic, or it's considered to be cosmetic. So it's you don't have any sort of a third party payer problem. There's only one, the person who elects to have the surgery pays for it him or herself. So price is $4,000 per eye, and today you can get surgery for as low, that was 1998. So today you can get surgery for as low as $300 per eye, and you have all of these new places that have popped up all over the place, laser eye surgery places. So certainly, that industry didn't decline into depression as a result of deflation. In fact, again, it was the low prices were an effect of the growth of the industry, okay? The growth of the amount of surgeries per year that were being offered on the market, okay? So I love growth deflation. You know, I love to see all prices go down to 10 cents or a nickel, because that would mean that obviously the costs are falling too, and so using less, fewer resources to produce those goods, and then more resources available to produce other goods in the economy. And of course, if your nominal wage hasn't changed, if your salary remains the same in terms of dollars, well then you can buy more hand calculators, more ATPVs, more LASIK surgery with the same amount of dollars. So it's this process of falling prices spreads the fruits of economic, what's called economic growth, to everyone, even people on pensions who have fixed pensions which do not adjust according to changes in prices. So their pensions are fixed. Even they are getting increases in their living standards as a result of the market's growth. Now, here's another type of deflation I identified. This doesn't happen as frequently or for long periods of time. It's known as cash building deflation. That's what I named it. It's when people want to build up the amount of money they're holding for whatever reason. It's derisively called hoarding, okay? So that's the term that you see in the money and banking textbooks, hoarding. But really, it's nothing more than an increase in the demand for money, okay? And it occurs when individuals reduce their spending on consumer goods, and businesses reduce households reduce their purchases of financial assets. Businesses reduce their purchases of physical assets, and because they want to hold more money. So this sort of cash building deflation occurs when people begin to spend less than their income. So if you receive if your income is $1,000 per month, and you're used to let's say spending $800 on consumer goods and $200 you're saving, and that's not holding money. Saving is purchasing stocks, bonds, mutual funds, putting your money in certificates of deposit. All of that money is spent by the person to whom you're loaning it to, okay, or the intermediary like the mutual fund or the insurance company or the bank is loaning it to. So that's not really holding money. But let's say now you want to hold more money in your checking account or in currency. What happens there then is that you spend, let's say, on investment assets and consumers goods, you only spend, let's say, $900 a month. And you put aside $100, you actually hold it. You don't invest it in interest anywhere, you hold it. Because let's say you're worried about the future, you're worried about losing your job, you're pessimistic about the prospects of the economy in general. So you can see in bullet point three there, economists use the word cash balance. That's the amount of money out of your income, your current income, that you do not spend or invest, that instead that you hold. So it's called it's the balance left over of what you spend out of your income. So if you don't spend all your income or loan it out to someone through investing it who does spend it, well then we call that a cash balance. And basically your cash balance is the amount of currency that you hold plus the amount of checking account deposits that you have. And as you see in red there, this usually occurs because houses and businesses, households and businesses become more pessimistic about the future, okay? Businesses start thinking that profits are not going to be very robust in the future, so they're not going to expand, so they cut back on the amount of investing they're doing, or even replacing capital equipment. Maybe they're allowing their capital goods to wear out and they're shrinking because they're worried about the future. Or households are, worried about the job, losing a job, okay, or taking a pay cut or not getting a bonuses. So they're cutting back and they're holding more cash, okay? And that's what is called hoarding, okay, in everyday language. But we know that is simply really simply an increase in demand for money. And as I said, this is not a long-run phenomenon in the market economy. Generally, it happens when the government has engaged in a policy that has made people uncertain, much more uncertain about the future. How much am I going to have to pay for Obamacare, one business might think. I don't know what the costs are going to be. I'm going to have to put money aside and not invest it. Or What is my tax bill going to look like if suddenly taxes are raised to close the deficit? So a household might put aside money, cut back on spending for that reason. So it usually occurs as a result of government policies that muck up the economy, or even a recession. If a government inflationary boom results in a recession, that's when people are really worried about losing money if they're business people, or they're worried about losing their jobs. And so they begin holding money for that future contingency. So that's all good stuff, right? I mean, because that allows you to gain some more security against this future uncertainty, okay? And in particular, businesses might engage in cash building during recessions, because what happens is that during a recession, prices may fall, but there might be but wages were raised tremendously, let's say, during the boom, and so profit margins are wiped out. So businesses are not going to invest in expanding and hiring more people until the wages and other costs have come down and adjusted so that there is a profit margin, so that costs are now below prices and it's worth investing, okay? And that's so the entrepreneurs, they hold cash and they wait until the input prices have fallen, okay, to a point where they feel that, well, it's now profitable enough for me to invest. And also, since there's uncertainty, they might not just want a 5% return on their money. They might say, look, you know, I have to build in some risk, so I need a 15% return. So initially, wages might have to actually fall much more than they would have in normal times before businesses begin investing. Then once they gain confidence, their aversion for risk begins to disappear. And it's especially bad if government doesn't allow prices to fall. It has not allowed asset prices to fall. It's housing prices in the latest so-called recovery from the Great Recession. And when that happens, businesses do not see their costs falling. They continue to hold money, okay, rather than invest it. So really, cash building deflation is a response to government policies that distort the market and distort prices on the market. Okay, if the government moved away, stopped intervening, then prices would adjust, and you'd find this cash building deflation resolving itself. Okay, and what's the adjustment process? Well, misspelled there, excuse me. Basically, cash building means that you increase the demand for money. That's what people will do. And as they do so, and I've already explained this all pretty quickly, they decrease the demands for goods, or DG. There's the adjustment process in bullet point two. The demand for money goes up, which means people stop spending as much as they had before out of their income, so the demand for goods falls. That drives prices down. But that simply means that each dollar now buys more goods, okay? So there is no shortage of money when people demand more money than is available at the current price level. All that happens is that prices fall, okay? Prices adjust to the new situation so that the limited amount of money, fixed amount of money, now buys more goods and services because prices have gone up. Prices have fallen, okay? And you see that in bullet point four. Each dollar buys a greater quantity of goods. So with the same amount of money supply, the result is that you have a greater real money supply. Okay, so now you can buy, if prices are cut in half, to take an extreme example, that means you can buy twice as much with the same money supply in the economy. And I think I have an example of this in the next. Yeah, so let's see how increasing the demand for money increases the real money supply. You don't need the Fed to increase the number of dollars. People can do that on their own by increasing the demand for money. So I'm assuming in this example that pizza is a representative good for the economy, the only good supply. So let's say at time T1, there's $1,000 in money that has been created by the Fed. The price of pizza is $10. What would be the real money supply? That is, how many pizzas could a dollar buy, or could the whole money supply in the economy buy? So you divide the money supply in the economy, which is $1,000, divide it by the price of pizzas, and initially then the real money supply is 100 pizzas. stated in terms of physical goods, okay? And that's at that price level, you could buy 100 pizzas with the whole money supply. Now, let's say that at T2, people want to hold twice the amount of money because they're very uncertain about what's going to happen with the deficit, what's going to happen with Obamacare, whether taxes are going to go up. In any case, the demand for money doubles. They'd like to hold 1,000 at the level of prices that we have now. So everyone cuts back on the amount they buy, but that just puts downward pressure on prices. So prices fall to $5. They're cut in half. And lo and behold, what happens to real money supply? Well, it increases, as you can see, okay? Even though you have $1,000 now, since the price of pizza has fallen to $5, you now have a real money supply that's double. You can now buy the same $1,000, you can buy 200 pizzas, okay? So cash billing has resulted in doubling of the money supply, okay? And the number of the purchasing power of dollars held has now been doubled. Okay, and despite the fact that the Fed did not increase the money supply, the market was able to adjust the price level to lower it. So it's good because it increases real money supply in response to the increase in monetary demand, so it's meeting consumer demand there, and it provides consumers with greater insurance against future uncertainty. Each dollar now buys more, so they are more secure. And it also, from the point of view of businesses, readjusts prices downward, especially wages and other input prices that hadn't yet fallen. So when it does that, when costs fall, because businesses are withholding the amount that they're investing, then the costs will drop below the prices and give them a return that they're comfortable with, and that will give a stimulus to the economy. So it's actually, believe it or not an increase in spending that you want in the economy. You want the decrease in spending on the right things, the things whose price have risen too much, let's say the costs have risen. So that restores, that causes the economic stimulus, okay? Not trying to prop prices up, prop wages up, but quite the reverse. So economic welfare is increased. Okay, bank credit deflation, that's caused, this is a third type, it's caused by bank runs when depositors and note holders in the old days, banks up until the 1920s were permitted to issue notes, their own notes as well as their own checking deposits. So when people lost confidence in the banks, they would rush to the banks in order to exchange their notes and deposits for gold, okay, or other forms of cash, okay. And that occurred regularly during recessions before World War II, okay? When you had a recession and some businesses went bankrupt and were unable to repay their bank loans, the bank now suddenly found that people were nervous and were rushing in to try to retrieve their cash. And the banks, of course, are fractional reserve banks. They wouldn't have all the cash on hand. They might have 20% of the cash on hand. And so the bank run would lead to the bankruptcy of the banks. The banks would fail, okay, and would not be able to redeem on demand all of their notes and deposits, okay? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it will cause the money supply to shrink, certainly. And by the way, other banks that are not failing but are worried about a bank run will call in their loans, reduce the amount of deposits that they've issued and the amount of loans. That will decrease the money supply even further. Okay, so the result would be a fall in the money supply, okay, a shifting to the left of the money supply curve. That's to allow the economy to continue to operate, okay? Each dollar would buy more. Why is this efficient? Why is this a good state of affairs? Why does this benefit consumers? Well, basically, the banks are failing because they cannot fulfill their contractual obligations. I'm not taking a stand on fractional reserve banking on the ethics one way or the other, but certainly it's the obligation of banks that enter into fractional reserve contracts to pay off their depositors and, in the old days, their note holders when they show up at the bank and demand their property, which is the cash that the bank is holding. Okay, so we would say that if a firm that was inefficient and didn't live up to its contracts, a law firm failed or an auto firm failed, we'd say that's a good thing. you're shifting resources from the inefficient firm that cannot fulfill its contract to other firms that are more efficient and that are better at serving consumers. So it's a good thing when these bad firms go out of business because it releases resources so that other firms can expand, the other firms being the more efficient firms. So I don't see why that doesn't apply to banks. Of course it should apply to fractional reserve banks. It's also good because it serves as a warning to existing banks and any new banks that want to come into the system that they should not follow the policies and practices of failed banks. So you would have the market disciplining fractional reserve banks, maybe even forcing them not to issue any more unbacked loans and deposits, okay? But that's something we have to find out from the market itself, okay? Some people who believe in free banking would say something like, well, if the government got out of the market altogether, free banks would operate efficiently and they would lower the reserve they need, okay? They would expand the money supply. Well, that remains to be seen. You know, let's get the government out of the picture completely. Let's get all central banks out of the picture. I'm willing to look at a system like that, have a system like that where there's no lender of last resort, where there's no Fed printing up money or central bank printing up money, bailing banks out. Let's see what kind of banking system evolves from that. And it's good because it transfers resources to those depositors and those depositors who are shrewder and who are the ones that pick the banks that are more prudent and responsible in their policies, okay? And that's true of people who purchase products from better firms, okay? Others, you know, tend to be dissatisfied with their products. Okay? Well, the same thing is true with people who lose their cash in failed banks, okay? Where failed banks are not able to repay all of the depositors. So it's a cleansing process, just like it is for any other industry. Okay, let me just jump to confiscatory deflation. I want to end with this. As I said, the word confiscatory, but sometimes does not show up if you type it in a word program or something. It won't show up, but it is a word. Mises uses the word human action, and it comes from the word confiscation, and it describes some action by government in the way I'm using it, either confiscating your income and wealth through taxation or confiscating it through taking deposits from people. Okay, so let's look at what that actually means. So this type of deflation occurs when the government freezes, something they call freezing people's deposits in the banks, okay? Either partially or completely. And it's usually an attempt to reverse the previous inflation or to protect the central bank's reserves if they're on what we call a fixed exchange rate standard, okay? It's happened in a number of places. You see them there in third bullet point, Argentina, Brazil, actually twice in Argentina. In recent times, Brazil, USSR, happened in Ecuador. And it just recently happened in Argentina once again, okay, a few months ago. So let me take the Argentine example, the earlier example. Money supply, they're very inflationary. Money supply increased by 60% per year in the years 1991 to 1994. Then in 96, it slowed down, increased by 15%, and then 20% in 1997, and then it was stopped. Okay, so the bank, central bank stopped the inflation. And the money supply decreased by 10% in 2000 and mid 2001. The bank was losing reserves, so there was a credit inflation. And they had to reduce the money supply. Banks lost 17% of their deposits. Now, at that point, Argentina was on a dollar, had a dollar currency board, meaning that each peso that the central bank issued was backed up by a full dollar, okay, of U.S. currency. But once those dollars those pesos and dollars got into the banking system. The banking system, which was a fractional reserve banking system, pyramided more pesos and more dollar deposits on top of those central bank reserves. Okay, and then when people lost confidence in the bank, they began to try to pull their money out. And they were allowed to take money, withdraw money from the bank in the form of pesos or in the form of dollars. Okay, but there were not enough dollars, dollar reserves held by the central bank to accommodate all those demands because of the fractional reserve banking on the part of the Argentine banks. So the central bank was left with reserves of about $5.5 billion, and they were backing at the end in 2001 about $70 billion of peso deposits. Now remember, Argentines had the right to withdraw any peso deposits they had in the form of dollars. Okay, so the banks had both dollar deposits, see there, plus peso deposits of $70 billion. But no matter what kind of deposit you had, peso or dollar, you could withdraw it in the form of dollars. Okay. They lost between $700 million to $2 billion on one day. Remember, they only had $5.5 billion. So at that point, the government stepped in to preserve the banking system, and we had the confiscatory deflation, as we'll see here. What they said was that from December 1st, cash withdrawals from banks were limited to $250 per week. Okay, so no matter how much money you had in your checking account or savings account, you couldn't withdraw more than $250 a week. So they're freezing part of your balance, okay, part of your cash balance, which meant that you couldn't spend it. So in that sense, it was deflationary. Okay, so it was limited for 3 months to $250 per week. But there was no limit on check or credit card payments because that didn't withdraw money from the banks. Okay, it just shifted money between the different banks. They also limited overseas cash transactions for more than $1,000. You couldn't send more than $1,000 out of the country for transport out. And then retail trade came to a standstill, as you see there. And then they added more of these interventions. A year later, all savings accounts above $3,000 was frozen for 1 year, and deposits with less than $5,000 could be withdrawn in 12 monthly installments. So you're allowed to withdraw some of it, starting, however, 1 year in the future. So all of these things represented a confiscation of at least part of the people's cash balances, part of their money. Okay. So what were the results of some of this? Many poor households in many parts of the world, including Argentina, they lack credit cards and checking accounts. Okay, so they depended on cash. Okay, and as there was scarcity of cash in the economy, they were hurt. The Argentine economy began to be demonetized. People began to turn to barter. They used corn, soybean, wheat. Became media of exchange, particularly contracts to buy to sell wheat. Okay, so auto dealerships were actually buying and selling wheat grain for autos. Okay, they actually had classes where they taught their employees how to barter the vehicles for cash, for grain. Okay. Now let's finish up with the question: does deflation cause depression? Because that's what it was claimed by that's the position that is now held. I mean, this position was really formulated in a very persuasive way by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz in their book *A Monetary History of the United States*, which was published in 1963. The same year that Murray Rothbard's American Great Depression came out. And in their book, Friedman and Schwartz claim that, and we talked about this last week, or 2 weeks ago, excuse me, Bob spoke last week, but 2 weeks ago we talked about this a little bit. They made the claim that it was monetary policy, the Fed deflating the money supply, that brought about the Great Depression. So in their mind, deflation was a cause of depression. And this was picked up by modern economists, especially after the Keynesian model failed. So Ben Bernanke, in fact, at a dinner, I guess it was, where Milton Friedman was being honored, Ben Bernanke said, "We did it, and we will never do it again. And we apologize," meaning we caused the Great Depression, and we don't intend to do it again. And we did it, meaning we, the Fed, did it by deflating the money supply. Okay. So there were a number of two economists, Akerson and Kehoe, who studied the link in a very simple way, empirical way, between deflation and depression. So they used a certain kind of data from 16 countries. And each country had data for at least 100 years, okay? And they broke these years into five-year periods. And during those periods, or during the 100 years or more that they were studying, for those 16 countries, there were 73 deflation episodes that they identified and 29 depression episodes. Now, you would think if there was a link that all 29 depression episodes would have occurred along with a deflation episode. Now, here's what they found. Here's what they concluded. They concluded that the data suggests that deflation is not closely related to depression. And they say a broad historical look finds more periods of deflation with reasonable growth. Okay, so there's more periods of deflation, of those 79 periods, with reasonable growth than with depression, and many more periods of depression. Okay, so many more of those 29 depression periods that occurred with inflation, along with inflation, rather than with deflation. And they conclude, overall, the data show virtually no link between deflation and depression. This article was published in a very prominent journal, the American Economic Review, one of the leading journals in the economic profession. But you rarely see it being referred to by economists. Okay, so we're back to where we started from, inflation phobia. So I will end there. What I did was I, again, categorized types of deflation. I showed you which ones were good and why they were good, which ones were bad and why it was bad, then ended showing that really empirically we can't find a link between deflation and depression. So I will take questions at this point. So let me just look at some of the questions here and try to answer them. Okay, hold on a second. Fix this here. Okay, so someone says, but in an over-leveraged financial system, such as the world today, aren't falling prices indeed bad? Falling prices are certainly bad for those people who have become over-leveraged, okay? And this is mainly asset prices, okay? We've had a lot of asset price inflation. That's what the run-up to the financial crisis was an asset price inflation. There wasn't much inflation judging by consumer prices or the way the Fed judges consumer prices from 2001 to 2006. But there was a heck of a lot of inflation of stocks, of real estate, housing, commodities, and so on. Okay, so people who borrowed, to finance their purchase of assets, that's very bad for them. They're over-leveraged. If asset prices fall, what do they have to do? They have to sell these assets at lower prices, okay, and pay off what debts they can and go bankrupt. But that's a good thing because they're the ones that made the error, okay? In fact, had this been allowed to happen, the housing market would have restarted much more quickly. That is, there are people out there who are more prudent who didn't rush in to buy houses because of low mortgage rates, didn't buy houses that payments they could not afford over time, especially if the interest rate jumped up on these adjustable rate mortgages. So these people would have been the ones that purchased the the assets. So the assets are going to go, I mean, they'll be resold at lower prices. You'll have a fall in prices in production, the cost of production, which would then restart the economy much quicker as entrepreneurs became more certain that they would feel more confident in the future and their future profits. Okay. So next, another question. I hope I answered that. Another question asks, you show where Mises and Rothbard are logically flawed and or make all the connections that should be made with deflation. Where else do you think that Mises and Rothbard make errors? Is there a paper that summarizes these? Yeah, I did argue in the paper that this lecture is based on, that Mises and Rothbard were unwilling to, in some cases, for example, when Great Britain had inflated during World War I, and they were wanted to go back to the gold standard after World War I, they went back at a price that was overvalued. They tried to deflate the economy. And their unions, especially their the labor unions in the coal industry, refused to take wage cuts. So Great Britain's depression didn't begin in 1929 or 1930, it began in 1925, when they tried to go back to gold at the old parity. In other words, the value of the British pound in terms of gold was much lower, okay? The price of gold had risen, and they were trying to go back at $4.86 per ounce of gold, or rather $4.86 per pound, that is, for their own currency. But in fact, their own currency had depreciated by about 10%. So they needed to bring their prices down by 10%. And it was difficult for them to do that. And so finally, they went back to gold at an overvalued price of the pound. What that means is that their prices on world market were very high. So they weren't able to export a lot of things, and there was, because they were expensive. And so there was a lot of layoffs and a depression. Okay. So Rothbard and Mises, and most economists would say, that, well, they should have simply devalued the currency. They should have cut the value of the British pound in terms of gold, the US dollar, by 10%. Okay. So to recognize that they've inflated, rather than trying to deflate back to the old value. And so I said, well, you know, maybe that's, you know, that isn't necessarily an improper thing to do, but why not allow a deflation? Okay, to get the economy started. I mean, I think they're wrong about that. It would have been good. Would have been good either way. But they took a middle stance where they tried to get the U.S. to inflate, and then they went back at an overvalued parity, meaning an overvalued pound in terms of gold and the dollar, and so their exports suffered. Okay, so. I wouldn't call it an error. It was Mises and Rothbard's preference that they should have gone back at recognize the past deflation and the value. And I was just putting that out there as an alternative. Well, why not, you know, have deflated somewhat, continue the deflation, and go back at the old parity. Do we have any others here? Okay, let me look at some others. Okay, someone here says that it bears me, quotes me, says it bears reiteration that deflationary monetary policy is not the only or necessarily the best route back from fiat to commodity-based money. And that was my point. What are other ways, routes from a fiat to commodity-based money? Well, one route back is what Mises and Rothbard suggests. That is, let's say right now you have a gold price of, you know, $1,500, whatever it is. So instead of going back at the old parity, which used to be $35 per ounce up until 1971, okay, from 1933 or so, or even it was $20 an ounce from 1834 until 1933. Instead of trying to, you would have to deflate the number of dollars in the economy way back you have to reduce it tremendously to go back to a price of gold at $35. You can go back at a price of $1,500 or $2,000. Okay, that is go back to the market price. So that's one way to go back. Okay, that is have the value of reserves in the banks for each dollar. Have each dollar be worth one divided by $1,500. Let's say $2,000 to make it simple. One over $2,000. Okay, so one 2,000th of an ounce of gold. Each dollar would buy one 2,000th of an ounce of gold. So it would take $2,000 to purchase an ounce of gold. So if you go back to the gold standard, you'd have to get a gold ounce from the bank, you'd have to bring in $2,000. That's another way of doing it. These questions have to be discussed in more detail, especially in today's world. Okay, I think a better way of going back, by the way, is simply to allow competition with the U.S. dollar. Allow it from foreign currencies as well as from gold and silver. And the way to do that, the first step, is to repeal the legal tender laws so that the U.S. dollar is no longer legal tender. People can make contracts in other types of currency. What other types? Well, that's where we have to repeal more taxes. Get rid of the sales tax, the excise tax, capital gains taxes on all foreign currencies so that people are allowed to hold deposits at U.S. banks in the form of euros or yen or Swiss francs. And if those things go up in value in relation to the dollar, they're not taxed on that, okay? Also allow banks to accept gold and silver coins, okay? And allow them to hold deposits in gold and silver. So there you would have currencies other than the dollar, as well as gold and silver, competing with dollars on an even footing, okay, where they're not taxed, where they're not discriminated against through certain laws. And so then if the dollar begins to lose purchasing power, people can make contracts with whatever money they want to. And so hopefully that, or possibly that could lead back to a gold and silver standard. But at least in the meantime, people would have choice in currency. And this was Hayek's program. He wrote a little pamphlet in 1995, and I think it was 1975 on this. Okay. It may have been called just currency choice. Okay. Someone asked, is there an article or book that you recommend that details these ways back? Well, there's a book that has come out, I think, last year by Lewis Lehrman on gold, and I don't recall the title now. Might be Back to Gold. But there he puts forward a detailed program on how we would go back to a classical gold standard, a gold standard like we had in the 19th century, up until 1914 or so. But one in which there would still be room for a Federal Reserve System. Okay, so that's one book that's fairly recent that details that. And also Rothbard details in his book Mystery of Banking one way of going back, and then a slightly different way, a book about 100% gold standard and the Mystery of Banking, how to get back there. And then in a later publication, The Case Against the Fed, he talks about how to go back to a classical gold standard, okay, a gold standard where you don't have all dollars fully backed by gold. So you might want to look at those two sources also. Another question is how the U.S., given that the U.S. is a world reserve currency and a fiat currency at the same time, how does this affect this analysis? Well, I don't, the analysis I've given here, I don't really think it really affects it. The U.S. is a fiat currency. It can be changed, the amount of quantity in circulation can be changed just by the will of the Fed. And the Fed can hold it constant also and stop inflating the money supply. Okay, it has the power to do that, to freeze the monetary base, stop it from increasing. Okay, the monetary base being the amount of currency in circulation and the amount of plus the amount of bank reserves. Okay, and that would stop the broader money supply, the checking account money, plus the currency from increasing also. Does it complicate matters, the fact that the U.S. is a world reserve currency? No, I don't think it really does, because if the U.S. froze the money supply, suddenly the U.S. dollar would begin to appreciate. Okay, prices would begin falling in the U.S., each dollar would buy more, so each dollar would be worth more in world markets. So more pounds, more euros, more Swiss francs would be given for the dollar. So the exchange rate for the dollar would appreciate, okay? Because the dollar now is buying more, that would be reflected in the fact that it was more valuable than other currencies, and so that you would have to pay more units of other currencies for the dollar. So the dollar would actually become a more desirable world currency, because people wouldn't be afraid of losing money as the dollar decreased and declined in value against things like the yen or the euro, which it had been doing. Someone asks, where does Selden disagree with any of this? He would disagree with my analysis of cash building deflation. Okay, so he's in favor of growth deflation. If you look at his book, Less Than Zero, where he defends falling prices when there's economic growth. Okay, but he does not think it's desirable to have a fall in prices that is due to bank credit deflation, okay, or cash building deflation. Okay, in fact, he was in favor of at least one round of quantitative easing and maybe a second round of quantitative easing that was carried out by the Fed to prevent the financial system from collapsing. Okay, and that's because he fears bank credit deflation, or he's against it, and he's also against allowing people, or rather, sitting back and doing nothing while there's an increase in the demand for money. Okay. He thinks that it would that reducing the amount of spending in the economy would occur when people hold more money and spend less. A decreasing amount of spending in the economy would cause a recession. So, in the meantime, he wants the Fed to increase the money supply along with money demand. So, if money demand increases, he wants the Fed to increase money supply by the same amount or by the same in the same proportion. And under free banking, he believed that free banking would do this automatically. The free banks would get signals from the market automatically to increase the amount of deposits when there's an increase in demand for money. Okay, I don't believe that. I believe that just allowing the money supply to increase along with the supply of gold would be sufficient to have an economy that was prosperous and growing. I don't think you have to offset fall in prices every time there's a change in the demand for money. Okay. Most of which, by the way, as I pointed out, occurs because of either wrong-headed government policies or uncertainty created by government policies, or the Fed preventing a fall in asset prices and wages and so on, causing entrepreneurs to want to hold money until their profit margins are reestablished. So yeah, Selden wouldn't disagree with my first category of inflation, that it's good. He would disagree that numbers 2 and 3 are good. He would say that they're bad. And as far as the fourth, I haven't seen him write on that, so I really don't know and can't speak to him on that. Another question asked, do you believe that today's central bankers actually fear deflation, or are they trying to mislead an educated public? I believe that they actually fear deflation, but I don't think they believe that it's imminent. Okay, this whole idea that we're right on the precipice, right? We're on the edge of falling into deflation. I don't think that they believe that that's actually true. In fact, look, they backed off and they're now talking not just about deflation, but about lowflation, that we can't let inflation get too low. So evidently there are no signs of deflation, but lowflation or low inflation may lead or may set us up to fall into deflation. So while their fear might be genuine in some theoretical sense that if we ever did have inflation, we'd have depression again, their fear that it's going to happen right around the corner, that's bogus. Okay, that is manipulating, that's used to manipulate the public into accepting Fed's inflationary policies. Which inflation targeting, which they talk about, targeting inflation at 2%, that's still inflation. I mean, what's so good about losing 2%? of your money value every year. Okay. We have a question. While the Austrian business cycle theory explains primary causes of the business cycle through government intervention with money supply, what, if any, would be the possible causes of recessions and depressions in a free market? Okay. Well, I don't think you would have recessions or depressions as we think about them now. But you certainly could have what economists today might call supply shock recessions, meaning let's say that there is an earthquake that destroys a lot of factories and a lot of productive capacity. You would certainly, in that case, have a fall in production, temporary unemployment, and you know that would be pretty. That would be economy-wide. Or if you had a horrible drought that affected an agricultural economy and caused a great deal of loss of output, well, certainly then you would have lower living standards for a while and so on. But that's not the classic recession. War can also cause recession. Okay. People becoming hippies and working much less or deciding to, you know, to retreat to the hills and to live on small communes, that would reduce output in the economy, but that would be voluntary. So in fact, you would have recession. You could call that a recession if you want. There would also be fluctuation too in the economy, meaning that look, you could have GM collapsing or you know people suddenly changing their demand away from American cars and having a certain sector collapse, which would have secondary effects affecting other sectors. So, but that's just an ups and downs of business, okay, because of entrepreneurial errors in the economy. So I don't like to call that recession, but it could cause a blip, a movement down in the economy. Okay, looks like we have run out of questions. I enjoyed being here with you this evening and sharing my thoughts on deflation. And I will see you next week. Have a good evening.